That was a big day again today.
It was a huge day.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't too big, but
no,
it was huge enough.
Just compounding.
Last day of your visit, full day?
Yeah, last full day.
It's been great.
Yeah, as always.
More times, you got to come up more.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the reality of it.
Yeah, nah, it will continue. It's just such a beautiful neck of the woods here.
Yeah, it is good, eh?
Yeah.
Lucky to be here.
Yeah, just back from Sunset Rock.
Yeah, we went and saw a lovely sunset and we saw a beautiful thunderstorm rolling in. Might come and hit us. We'll see. It's on its way, but...
Maybe tracking slightly to the east of us.
Yeah, might just miss out.
It'd be nice if it does roll over. Nothing better than going to sleep to an evening thunderstorm. You know?
It's like the best thing of all time.
Yeah.
Like, I love it.
Yeah.
Like sometimes when it's like hasn't been rainy for a long time, I crave it.
Yeah.
Like, come on, give me thunder, lightning and pounding rain.
Yeah. The summer's up here. It just happens so consistently.
Yeah, yeah. Last summer was crazy. We had... Like through December, January, February, and even into March, it was stormy. Like I swear, I'm probably exaggerating, but it felt like every 2 or 3 days. You know, I'd go for a run in the evening at sunset, and there'd be lightning storms all around me because you can see so far up here in the mountains. Being that like kind of close feel to the sky, see all these storm systems rolling in and lightning hitting the other ridge, and I'm just running along, and then it's so good.
Well, you just had what was it? 2-3 years of La Nina back to back.
3 years, yeah. Which is a system that doesn't hit Tasmania. Doesn't really influence you guys.
No, not so much.
The same way, does it? Yeah.
No, it's not as influential.
It's very like more of a southern east coast thing, isn't
it? Yeah, it has an effect, but not to the same respect, you know.
Not in the same way.
Yeah. I mean, last time I came up here, it was pretty challenging to get out to Mount Vic because... It had been flooding.
That's right. Yeah.
So I was taking the train out here from the airport and ended up having to like get off the train because of a landslide and jump on a bus and then jump on the train again, I think, or maybe the bus just dropped.
It was really hard getting around here for a while though.
Yeah.
It was so many parts. Like I swear every week there was a new landslip and then they'd fix it and then we'd have like another 100 mils of rain and it would slip again and then a new spot and... Track lines being demolished by like rockfall and it was just like months and months of like chaos.
Yeah, even the other day, like over on the western side of the divide, like we went to go to the Wolgan Valley and the road was like fully closed still. And they were cutting a new track in, you know.
Oh really? So they're gonna build a new road.
Yeah, that's what it looked like. Yeah. You know, they would look like they were cutting an alternative track. So it must have been like, you know, beyond repair because it looked like a pretty significant road that runs in there.
Being the only road too, probably like looking at their options and thinking, is this sustainable?
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting to explore up in there.
Beautiful part of the world, yeah. We'll have to hike out there one day from the Nunes Plateau.
Yeah, drop down.
At the Glowworm Tunnel and drop down.
Yeah.
It's a great view because you've got that mountain in the middle. So you get like a view of that with the valley all surrounding it. It's really, really nice.
Yeah, I was flicking through that Lost Mountains book yesterday morning.
Yeah.
And I hit that canyoning section and I was like, that's the special spots, I reckon, where not a lot of people get to see. And I was thinking, we need to get out and,
you know. Yeah, canyoning would be a really interesting way to, you know, on the theme of like getting bonsai inspiration, seeing environments that create maybe even creating literally trees, but environments that kind of exist at the bottom of landscapes that house ancient trees, like those rainforests.
Yeah.
Where those canyons exist.
And the hanging gardens that you get a lot in the shaded areas in the Blue Mountains. I imagine some of those deepest canyons would have some of
those. Yes,
like, absolutely. You know, where the epiphytic growth over the rock faces is just,
yeah,
it doesn't roast in the summer, you know, so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, another amazing thing about the Blue Mountains is a place called Hanging Gardens.
Yeah.
Which is.
I think we went out there last time.
The bees, I call them, I don't know if this is the official word, but I call them bees nests, kind of like wasp nests,
the rock.
Sphagnum moss bogs that are hanging. Like a big booger hanging off the rock.
With all the big like rishia clumps coming out of them. Yeah.
Apparently it's the only, I don't want to overstate, but it's definitely the only landscape like that in Australia, like if not
hanging,
the world.
A hanging sphagnum bog.
A hanging swamp. That's what they sort of coin it as.
Yeah, cool.
It's got the same flora you'd find in a swamp, but on a vertical surface rather than horizontal.
That'd be fun to play with.
Yeah. I think it'd be really interesting. Get a nice piece of stone and create some sort of continual moisture system to
like a ridiculously large kusa. So you get like outrageous 2 meters tall.
Man-made, man-sized kusa.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love playing with Kusa in the sense of like not being confined to scale.
I think that's the misconception with it. You know, you see those.
Doesn't have to be the size of coin, and it can be.
No, they're not all Shidakusa. They don't all have to be displayed with bonsai. They can be displayed in their own right, you know. Yep. And I think there's so much scope to play with that. It's just like a botanical art form, you know.
To me, it's like such a, it's a way to explore what bonsai has to offer, but being able to delve into any piece of plant.
Yeah.
Any piece of landscape. Like really broadening your horizons as to what gives you that. Because I know for me, a lot of my practice is about translating the experiences I have in the landscape.
Yeah, and
Kusamona is just like another way to do that. Exploration of
place.
Yeah.
And you can create them so quickly.
Yeah. And they really take initiative for themselves. A lot more, say, than maybe a bonsai does.
Yeah.
Like a woody plant does.
You just kind of tend it.
You know? Yeah, yeah. You pluck a weed here and there. Yeah. Or you let a weed grow here and there, you know. You let them become kind of gross and then they get better.
Yeah, or they fail completely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Become something entirely different. Yeah. But no, those rocky hanging systems really house some really interesting flora and fauna.
The rock climbers would see some pretty interesting stuff out here in the mountains too. But I think, you know, that might be beyond my adventurous capabilities.
Yeah.
Without a guided.
I have two friends. Actually, the couple who are moving up here, Tommy and Lauren, they're not ex-rock climbers. They used to rock climb a lot. That's how they met. Two young people in bonsai have just moved into the mountains. Yeah, they were pretty keen to potentially get back into rock climbing and take me with them. So
if you're a rock climber and you're up here, you're mad.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited. Well, I'll give it a whirl. If I like it, I always liked it when we did it like gyms and things like that.
Yeah, with your your height, you'd have really good ability.
Spider limbs.
Yeah, well, you get extra reach, you know.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And you know, you're pretty lean. You know, so that also, you get the right build to rock climb.
Mm. Just got to build up that strength.
Yeah, just don't get into free soloing, mate. We want you around a bit longer.
You know me, go hard or go home. I probably will.
No,
we'll see. I've got to stay alive for bonsai.
You know? Yeah, the trees need you.
They need me.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of rock sides and cliff sides and things like that, one thing we wanted to sort of talk about today was kind of the history of the collected tree in Australia.
Yeah.
And one space which I think maybe a lot of people don't realize, and I didn't realize for a long, long time, was probably the original Yamadori, if we use that word, for in Australia, at least in the Sydney region, is the ficus.
All over Australia, for sure. Yeah. Pretty much, at least right through to the subtropics.
Yep, yep, 100%, even to this day.
Yeah.
But definitely one of the OG collected trees. And you can see the evidence on older ficus bonsai in people's collections. Ficus circulate between people's collections pretty rapidly and readily.
It's amazing. Yeah, the distribution and the continuous changing of hands, quantity, mass quantity. And I think the undervaluing of them is, if you go to sell one, the value is not there for the quality of the tree, I think, a lot of the time.
It doesn't correlate necessarily.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can pick up some phenomenally good quality ficus for... Oh.
Some of my most favorite
backyard basement prices.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, what a great opportunity if you admire those kind of trees to get hold of some world-class material. No joke, world-class material. Yeah. But unfortunately, they get the rap of, it's just a ficus.
Yeah.
And that seems to exist across the world. You know, you hear that, oh, it's just a ficus bonsai.
But once you get an eye for it, it's unmistakable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have either, remnant, like a root that might key you into it, a long root from a crack or somewhere where it's been resting on stone, or the bark as
that
well.
That sunburnt or that really textured section.
The wartiness.
Yeah. I think it either suggests that it's a very old section of the trunk. You know how much ficus morph into something entirely different over a short period of time, let alone 50 years. But I feel like that texturing is a mixture of age and exposure from when they were on the rock back in the day.
Yeah, that thick bark as well that you see on very few ficus, the really, really old ones, you know, they get it.
Yeah, when I see that on a ficus and the material is good, I'm like, give it to me.
Straight into the garden.
Even though I don't have nowadays a lot of room in my garden for such compositions, because in this climate I do have to greenhouse them pretty much throughout the whole year.
Yeah.
It means they grow phenomenally, which is actually something I didn't really expect moving here, being in a... Probably you wouldn't classify this climate as truly cool temperate, but it's it's cool temperate for a good portion of the year. Definitely was in the past, but probably more of a colder end of warm temperate. But
yeah,
they need protection in the winter for sure.
Yeah, I even have one down in Tassie. Yeah. You know, I've had multiple over the years that I've just sold through because,
yeah,
you know, growing up here, you see such good quality. A lot of the ones that you handle down there, they're not quite that good. But I mean, recently one came into my garden that was exceptional quality. The way these things do, it was from a deceased estate of an artist from up in Devonport by the name of Des Saunders. Yeah, and the tree would be at least 50 years in cultivation with him. But yeah, undeniably Yamadori, you know, in the back it's got a big knee-kicked root, you know, and old bark and deadwood, which is sound deadwood. You know, you can flick it and it's
that's the thing, solid. You can on an old ficus when they have deadwood, it's iron. That's a slow-grown piece of wood, you know, because ficus get kind of the
bungy.
Yeah, they're kind of, you know, people talk about if you get a bit of deadwood on ficus, don't create deadwood because it won't last, and it is true. Yeah. But if it was there existing from its days of collection, that's some old wood. Because some of these ficus, they could be hundreds of years old.
Yeah, easily, undoubtedly.
Easily.
Yeah, and this one would have come in from the mainland. So, you know, there's been a trade in these plants. Either it was harvested by Des or someone he knew on the mainland, or he acquired it somehow.
Absolutely,
It came in. And a lot of ficus, actually, there's a number of them that have come into Tassie over the years. I know Tony Hewer, again, another artist from Tasmania that's unfortunately recently passed away. Yeah, he had a number that had come in, I think, from Megumi.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, and beautiful old trees, you know.
I know you as well as I. We definitely grew up in our early days of bonsai as teenagers, playing with a lot of ficus.
Yeah, privet and ficus and umbrella plants.
You were further enough north to get wild umbrellas.
Yeah, the Schefflera. A lot of those I collected them out of, I used to love climbing trees, and a lot of them you'd find them climbing, if you were climbing big old ficus or big old, a lot of like wild camp laurel up there that were originally brought into the area for cabinetry timber. Mm-hmm. They've just overtaken the area.
Yeah.
But if you, they're massive, you know. And yeah, you climb up and in the crooks of the branching where the humus would accumulate from leaf litter, sometimes you could find quite incredible plants, you know, and you could just sort of lift them out. And
pocket trees in the trees.
Pocket trees in the trees, you know.
Yeah, I think I was listening to, if it was a video or a podcast of Juan Anduado, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Costa Rica.
Yeah.
Studied in Japan, and he was talking about, I think it was maybe on a Bonsai Mirai live session that he was on or something like that.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the notion of the collected tree in a tropical climate. He was sort of talking about exactly what you're speaking of there.
Yeah.
In that pocket trees can exist in the crook of a tree, not just in the crevice of a rock. You get the same stunting effect from those environments.
Yeah, it's still a pocket.
Yeah. It's a pocket. It's a contained environment.
Yeah.
And the ficus, they're existing there until eventually might take them 200 years to get a root down to the soil, or they're waiting for the tree to die so they can slowly get their roots into the rotting matter and consume it. But they'll hold out for long periods of time, being stunted little representations of ancient ficus.
Geez, aren't those like climax epiphyte ficus incredible? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've experienced any of them, but
up in the best I've seen was in the Bunya National Park.
Yeah,
that blew my socks off.
Yeah,
when they're twice in one year, just because I just couldn't get enough of it.
I remember I used to do a little bit of bass fishing up where I grew up, and I'd often go up into the sort of like more remote streams, just because you'd get like nature and good fishing and clear water, and just there's a beautiful setting. There was a section between Nightcap and Goonangarry that I used to often fish. Yeah, and up in that area you'd find some stunning examples of that alongside some big like red cedars. But I remember one day climbing up the inside of one.
I've done this, you know, too.
And it's like, you know, it's like a ladder in there from all the lace work of roots that have then fused, and the old tree rots out from the interior, and you've got a hollow
trunk.
Yeah, and they sit above the canopies of the forest. Mm-hmm. So you can climb up until you hit a point where there was an old mature branch from the previous tree, and then you get a porthole, you know, out over the canopy.
Yep.
So incredible. If you don't mind getting the cobwebs and the bat encounters.
Pretty dank little environment.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's not for the faint of heart.
Spider-ridden.
And also you go a long way up. So if you look down that hole you've just come up, it's a long way if you fall down that hole, it's going to be a bad experience.
I climbed one like that in the Dorigo, in Dorigo.
Yeah.
And it was quite frightening how high up you get.
Yeah, but the allure of what might be further up just keeps driving up, and you can keep finding handholds. Even though the handholds are a bit like what's going to be in here when I put my hand in this dark crevice as you're going through spider webs to go up those tunnels, you're kind of thinking like, oh.
I'd love to do more of that. It's not often you get to climb the interior of an ancient tree.
Yeah, right. Yeah. What an experience.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
So unique. When I went to the Bunyas, it was only last year. Yeah, last year.
Yeah.
And that was just, I was astounded on the Strangler Fig Ficus, because it's an old, old, old growth forest, mixture of Bunya pine, red cedar, lily pili species. And Strangler Fig, that were kind of the main four. And, you know, some of these red cedars are just the biggest I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And the Bunya's just ginormous. And then the Strangler Fig, bigger again, because they are the trees consuming these massive ancient 1,000-year-old trees.
Yeah.
And the Ficus were just incredibly large.
Yeah.
Like towering, like you say, towering above the canopy, and then the limbs that spread out would be as big as the cedars on the ground. And then you look at the, you know, there might be 6, 7, 8, like an octopus ring of limbs heading out into the canopy. And then they just trail off into the, and you don't see where they end. Yeah. It was like this reverse environment where it's like you're looking up at the root system or something.
Yeah.
The branch, it's just so stunning.
Yeah.
So captivating.
They're amazing. Have you ever seen the red cedars in spring? Like when they're a deciduous tree, right? But they don't get an autumn color per se. They sort of just shed their leaves.
No, they just kind of drop.
The seasonal color comes in is in that new flush of growth. It's beautiful.
It's like a coppery kind of color. Yeah.
And that was unfortunately one of the tells for the timber getters out in the mountains because they would go up in the spring and they could look up a valley and they could spot them, you know.
Yeah.
And they'd just shoot them down into the rivers and because that's where it's one of the reasons my hometown existed, Lismore, is because it was a confluence of two large rivers that had really good timber upstream.
A logging cedar and things like that.
So they just sent them down the snigging tracks into the river .
And for those listening, cedar is one of those names of trees that gets kind of thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
It's not a true cedar. They're actually a broadleaf, deciduous tree to Australia.
Yeah.
Non-colouring, but deciduous nonetheless. Yeah, there's some beautiful ones when you're going down the pass into Wollongong. When you're going down the hillside, because it was extensively logged too. Apparently it was like kind of the dominant tree in the forest down there in the Illawarra. But there's still remnant old ones on the really quite steep cliffside that you descend down into the city of Wollongong there. I have a client I go see there, and going in winter is really awesome because, I might go early in the year and they're all lush green and beautiful, towering above the other trees, and then they're deciduous trees and no leaves. And then, that spring copper glow is just...
Yeah, and super the timber lovely. Is, you know, the red cedar, it's more to do with the color of the timber, you know, beautiful red, like a mahogany. Yeah, if you ever see any furniture made from it, it's beautiful furniture. So you can understand why they lusted after it.
Yeah,
you
know. Makes sense. Yeah. Tall, straight, you know, powerful.
But going back to the ficus, one of the other forms that I love that ficus take on, you know, obviously, and we were talking to John about this today. So you get a multitude of forms, a strangler form, you know, like the big wide paddock forms. When I did some traveling further north into Queensland, there was also really extreme versions of the sort of aerial root style ficus.
Like so banyan almost.
Yeah, like just like draped in. Just like descending.
Like a curtain of aerial roots. Yeah,
curtains of aerial roots.
Yeah. There's that famous ficus in the... in the Dane tree called the curtain fig.
I went and visited that one.
Yeah, that's on my hit list.
Yeah, yeah, it was phenomenal. But yeah, they're such a magnificent tree. You know?
They are so variable, flexible, as in terms of, like we're saying, the forms that they take.
Yeah.
Actually, one place to see, it's incredibly accessible to see like ficus in a really sort of ancient, not ancient, but old representation and massive is just the Sydney Botanic Gardens.
Yeah.
Like
all around Sydney.
All around Sydney. There's the eastern suburbs of Sydney especially. Ginormous. Like, I mean, if you haven't been able to go out and see large trees, that's a way to see large trees.
Yeah.
In a park.
Yeah. In a city.
On the street edge.
Those trees in Sydney are
amongst townhouses.
Yeah, they're phenomenal. Nah. And they're so, like, in bonsai culture, insanely resilient. You know, like anyone, I think one of the reasons why there are so many ficus bonsai in Australia is if you start one, I mean, it's pretty hard to knock it over. You know, you can.
Yeah.
My first bonsai was a ficus. Mm-hmm. It's still alive. Yep. It's at mum and dad's house, you know, in varying states of neglect.
but it's fine. Right? It's never going to die.
It's fine. And it's, you know, over the years, it started as a pencil thick plant when I got it, maybe a 4-year-old plant. And now, you know, like over 20 years later, it's in a plate sized trunk, yep. you know, yep. fused aerial roots. And mm-hmm. funnily enough, they'll just, you see these poor ficus that have mm-hmm. been neglected for years. I had a customer call me the other day and it's like, oh, I need some assistance. I've got this 30-year-old ficus that's down in Tassie. Mm-hmm. I've got this 30-year-old ficus that I need help with. And I'm envisioning this, you know, beautiful 30-year-old ficus, right? Yeah. And I get around and it's this poor little sickly looking ficus with these long extended branches with like two or three leaves on each branch, just looking sickly yellow. And yeah, it's like, oh, I've had it for 30 years, you know, I've taken care of it for 30 years. And it's like, no, it survived your care for 30 years.
And I'd believe it. That's the yeah. phenomenal thing about them. Yeah. They can exist in a little pot, aka rock crevice.
Yeah, yeah.
And just be a little tiny sapling looking plant for decades.
Which makes you wonder how old some of these collected plants were that were, because they were removed in large numbers.
Yeah, I mean, we could be vastly underestimating the age.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, who knows? I don't know if anyone's done any studies on these type of little Krumholtzy ficus. They could be some of the most ancient trees in the country.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Well, I saw some over on the west coast of Australia, like northwest around Exmouth up in, there's some really nice gorges that run down to mm-hmm. pretty much, it's almost like a desertscape down to the coastline, which then has like Ningaloo Reef out off it. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. But up in the gorges, there's some beautiful, gnarly,
I can imagine, yeah.
just grumbly ficus in there. There's no real chance for like aggressive fire to move through a landscape like that. Yeah, yeah. So it's not going to wipe them out.
Yep.
Yeah, right. And so it's like, how long has this been perpetuating itself in this in this location?
And because ficus have that ability to like drop aerial roots and smother their own trunk, and which adds younger tissue to the exterior of the tree continually. In a sense, if they're continually doing that and they're not beefing up in size too dramatically, they may always have like a young appearance in terms of bark texture and things like this.
Yeah.
Because they're cloaking themselves in young tissue.
Well, the one you've got out there in the greenhouse that you dug from your mum's house just recently.
Just
like
recently,
it's a beast of a thing now. Yeah. But you said you started that as like a group of, what were they, like 40-year-old?
Yeah. They like came from Bebo Bonsai Nursery, which was a nursery on the Central Coast.
Yeah.
Andrew Edge took over that nursery early 2000s. That was close to when I was starting bonsai and he was closing it down, maybe 2007, I'm gonna guess, and I started bonsai in 2005-06. So I went up there and got a bunch of ficus, you know, old sort of field grown ficus.
Yeah.
Morton Bays, actually. Yeah, and they had been growing in that field for 30-40 years by the original owners. And they had like that really smooth elephant trunk appearance to the trunks, gnarly little interesting little quirky bends, very weak. They were very, very weak, and they must have been in that weak slow growing state for so long and composed this forest. Like years later they were just all in pots.
Yeah,
put it on there and then put that forest on the rock wall at mum's place, and there it stayed for the last like decade and a half. And it had escaped, as they do. It had escaped the slab that it was on, and roots had gone into the rock wall and into the garden bed at the back. And yeah, they had grown so thick and so large, like from what were maybe 2-3 inch trunks, they'd become, gosh, maybe like 15 centimeter, 20 centimeter, 25 centimeter, some of them thick trunks. But the tissue looks like it's
looking
a one.
At them, like, they could be 10 years old.
They could be
now,
10 years old, right? Yeah.
They've shed away any remnants of antiquity.
Yeah, there's nothing left of that
they're
old
large,
bark. Yeah.
But they, you know, if you stuck a heap of cuttings in the field now and grew them well,
they could be like that in 6 years.
Six years, I reckon.
Fascinating how they can go into this youthful look.
You know? I think a lot of trees can do that. Ficus just do it very, very quickly.
Yeah, their ability to rapidly thicken in that tissue is just so much greater.
Yeah, I mean, you take any old bonsai, like an old, like you could take a 40-year-old tree.
Yeah.
Once it gets established in the ground, you give it 10 years, you could never tell it was an old plant again.
Set it free.
Yeah, right.
I had a ex-partner from university. Whenever we'd have a little tiff or a fight, she would always threaten me with, I'll take your bonsai and I'll go plant them somewhere and set them free and I won't tell you where they are.
Yeah.
It was amazing. We would always joke about it afterwards. But
Well, on the topic of like historical Yamadori and setting things back into the wild, I remember seeing a video by Lindsay Farr where somewhere in the southern ranges of Australia, him and another fellow, they take back an orthophagus that was collected and replanted into the bush.
Yeah, when you told me this the other day, yeah. I was like, what?
Yeah, it's a really beautifully curated video too. Mm-hmm. I'd love to track it down. I'm pretty sure it was part of that World of Bonsai series mm-hmm. that he created. And for anyone listening that has not sought out the World of Bonsai series by Lindsay Farr, seek it out. It's a phenomenal piece of bonsai yeah. videography created.
I mean, I remember when those videos were out, they were the first internet videos I think I ever found.
Yeah.
And potentially were really out there and in an yeah. abundant source. Yeah.
What an incredible job you did of documenting and all over Japan and China and and within his own nursery space.
Yeah. It was for its time and even to this day, a phenomenal project that Lindsay Farr put together.
Yeah. Kudos to Lindsay Farr for that. Yeah.
Shout out to Lindsay Farr from Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah. yeah. Have you ever been to his nursery?
I went once, maybe it's probably 10 years ago now. And I was in Melbourne and we went and visited the garden. I remember he was there, but he was busy talking to a few customers, so I didn't really disturb him. And I was kind of like a little bit of like, oh, there he is.
Yeah,
you know?
Like rock star vibes.
yeah.
I'm going quietly and I'm going to look around.
Yeah, he was having some like chats to a couple of people. So we just wandered around and it was amazing because it felt like a Japanese nursery in the sense that it was just rows and rows of benches of predominantly deciduous trees and pines.
Yeah.
Maples and pines. Yeah. And it was in autumn when I was there. So it was
so beautiful.
Red green.
He's got a lot of Japanese maples that have, got a lot of antiquity to them.
Yeah, that was a fun visit. I didn't get to meet him, but it was fun to visit and just see the space. And
it's not just been ficus that Australian bonsai artists have been collecting over the years. Prior to this conversation, we discussed like what we thought, what were the other species historically that, people had acquired from the native landscape to create bonsai from. And we thought, the Melaleucas in Western Australia were a big keystone.
Yeah.
And you've got Derek Oakley over there and Craig Murray. Both of those people have contributed a huge amount of trees.
Yeah, absolutely. They've got their own scene going over there in terms of really, really honoring the endemic native tree to their region, the Melaleuca species that they work with. And it's been for a long time.
Yeah. I mean,
it wasn't last year they started. It's been decades.
Yeah. Yeah. Derek was one of the first. I think he got some like scientific permits or something and went out and collected a large number of them. Did he mentor Craig at some stage? Or?
I'm not sure entirely actually, but I feel like at one point in time for sure.
Yeah.
I think that was a part of his story.
Both of these artists now have unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
But their collecting techniques are quite unique as well for those Melaleuca.
Very unique. Well, what they were collecting was predominantly, I think, Raphophila, Melaleuca Raphophila, and later Melaleuca Caticularis.
Yeah.
Melaleuca Caticularis. And both are absolutely phenomenal species for bonsai.
Yeah, they get really muscular looking trunks.
Yeah, I met a guy over there when I went 2 years ago and went to his garden. John was his name. And he had a Raphophila that he collected only 5 or 6 years prior. Phenomenal tree, amazing structural branching, secondary, like refined tree with just the most amazing natural structure to it.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is definitely collected. I was like, how long ago did you collect this? And he goes, oh, it's like 5, 6 years ago. And I was like, that must have been the most amazing find. And he pulls up his phone and shows me a picture.
Bought like a bare stump, right?
It was a bare cut stump at about a foot high.
With like no roots on them, just torn.
Huge big cut on the top.
Out of the ground. Yep. And they just stick them in a bucket of water.
Yeah. And all that muscling and that's just from growing new branches on those trunks. They set live veins and 5 years later, you got something that is kind of like the ficus, indescribable as to what it was prior.
Yeah.
But even a quicker time than a ficus, to be honest.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Like just totally great base, but just totally evolved into something. Full on Pokemon evolution.
Yeah, right. And then also in Victoria, they've collected a large number of coastal tea trees over the years from development sites where there've been coastal housing going in along coastal areas and
down in the southeast there.
Yeah. And they've got some beautiful coastal tea trees now that they've developed, and coast beard heath as well.
Yeah, the beard heath,
both species are phenomenal. In fact, I think the beard heath is
very beautiful.
It's really beautiful. I've been collecting a number of those this last couple of years, and they've got a lot of potential.
They do.
And if you can find, I mean, there's a lot of residential area on the coast.
I mean, most Australians live on the coast.
Lucky enough to be granted access to a large piece of private property, and has a lot of kunzea and a lot of beard heath on it. I found pretty good success even from open ground digging. And in Tasmania as well, the staple, the North of Vegas has been collected there for years.
Yeah, like all the way back in like the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I'm not sure how far back it goes. Yeah, but originally, one of the earliest known collectors I know of down there is Neil Farrell, Lynn Farrell's late husband. And he ran a bonsai museum, actually, in Tasmania. Originally, a nursery called the Brown Mountain Nursery. He collected quite a large number of really quite beautiful Nothofagus. And I think he also collected beard heath. There's an old article that Tony Hewer, one of our previous president to our bonsai club, also unfortunately now passed away. But I remember I was around at Tony's house and he pulled out an old magazine. I think it was like Bonsai Australia or one of these magazines. I need to acquire a number of these copies. So if anyone ever has these out there and they have a copy of this particular volume that has an article from Neil Farrell in it about collecting, he doesn't specify in the article what it was, but he talks about a species of tree he collected from the coastline of Tasmania and how phenomenal it was for bonsai and the performance of it. And then eventually he talks about the unfortunate nature of its demise when a eucalypt fell on top of it and crushed it to death.
Oh, yeah.
We don't make it.
Bloody eucalypt.
Yeah, those bloody pesky eucalyptus. Yeah, but they collected a lot of Nothofagus off, I think it was Mount Arthur up to the northeast of Launceston.
Right.
And I've got two of those trees in my garden now. And the antiquity on those trees is... even the pieces I collect now, they don't present the quality of bark characteristic that those pieces have.
Old pieces.
The beautiful silvery bark they get.
Yeah, it goes to show how much this has been a part of the bonsai culture for so long. Yeah. And it's funny because I feel like in more of the times that we exist in and for the last little while, it's something that I think the community hasn't really realized has been a part of our culture for this period of time. I know like a... collecting trees that are from Australia is often seen as something that's not possible.
Yeah.
Because you can't touch a native tree's roots.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, which applies to any tree if it's done inappropriately.
Yeah.
Or the selection of the material isn't done properly. Well, every tree is collectible.
You got to leave a lot of them.
Yeah, you know? Most.
Yeah.
If not the vast majority.
And you get a sense for it. You go, it's not worth the effort and it's not worth...
You've got a few filter systems. You've got... quality.
Yeah.
Probably number one.
Mm-hmm. That's the first thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You're looking for trees that are worth collecting.
Is the juice worth the squeeze on that front is the first one.
Yeah. And then is it collectible? Is probably the second biggest one. And that really narrows down what you can even access. The collectible part is, I think, the part that sort of pieces together the puzzle of how do you collect trees. It's a big part of it. Is it actually able to be collected? Is it in a situation based on how the species can be handled in terms of its root system to be extracted from the ground.
Yeah, and the aftercare is it's insanely different to what you would do if you were collecting in the United States or Europe or Japan, where you're collecting these mountain conifers where, you know, they put them into this super porous mix and keep them fairly dry and miss the foliage. Mm-hmm. The native broadleaf trees I collect, I drown them. I just keep...
It's kind of the opposite.
...water on them, you know, foliage and root system, you know, and remove... a portion of foliage as well as the other thing, like whereas on conifers you leave quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Broadleaf seem to be really, really, they fluctuate between being coniferous and that you leave a lot of foliage with the roots to almost cutting all of it off, like on a Melaleuca, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, the broadleaf tree collecting is a very variable exercise.
Yeah.
There's no like one tactic fits all, but there is that level of, probably slightly finer soils for recovery, more water, definitely on the wetter side, balancing out that very, very transpirational leaf mass to aid the recovery.
Yeah.
But definitely not removing all of it. I think on a lot of trees, that's potentially where a lot of people have gone wrong with collecting a lot of native broadleaf material is taking foliage away that could have driven the growth for the root system to recover. There's only those species like Melaleucas, especially the water.
I think it depends on the ability for backbudding as well.
Absolutely,
you know, what propensity does this? You know, for some species, it's the backbudding is phenomenal. So you know, you can take all the foliage off, no questions asked.
So long as it, I think it moves water efficiently.
Yeah,
because if they're not an efficient water mover, relatively, they need that foliage to help.
They got to off-gas so the pump doesn't fail.
Yeah.
So you don't want cavitation in the pump.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it is as simple as that. When you think about how a tree functions, they're just a big irrigation system. There's plumbing, there's moving resources around, and you've got to tap into how do you efficiently move that plumbing system to another location.
You got your inlet at the base, at the root tips, and you got your outlet at the top, yeah, out of the foliage.
That's it.
Yeah. But yeah, the ficus, I think, is it's certainly a staple.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I feel like a few of the ficus I've got in my garden were probably collected pieces in the past. One in particular that has some real antiquity to it is a piece from originally I got from Lee Wilson a number of years ago. And it has two... It's almost like if you look at it from certain angles, it's a perfect bow.
Yeah,
The way the two trunks interact.
Yeah.
The way the trunks interact actually remind me of Luis Vallejo's Scots pine that he has on that crescent slab.
Yeah.
Has I know the Europeans very much describe as a very awkward trunk line to marriage.
This is the one that just fell into his hands.
No, not David Benavente.
Right. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. What's his garden called again? Anyway.
Yeah.
Luis Vallejo, the architect. Mario Comstar, I think, looks after his collection.
Yeah, it's a beautiful space.
Absolutely stunning. Yeah, this ficus kind of reminds me of the awkward shape of this trunk. But the key characteristic of what signifies, again, that it seems like it's a collected piece is the very, 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 very sort of crusty, cracked bark
bark of any ficus out in the garden.
It's corky. It has fissures that are deep on it.
Yeah,
it's quite amazing. And I also know it's collected because Lee told me.
So like Lee collected a number, didn't he?
He collected a lot, sort of our younger days of doing bonsai. I believe that one was collected on the Central Coast, which is where I grew up, enough.
Yeah, and I know Rick Roberts as well collected quite a number as well. I saw an interesting video that the garden space that they're setting up?
Yeah, Rick Roberts' garden.
Yeah, they posted a video on YouTube, a story about one of the trees in Rick's garden. Yeah, apparently they collected it off the side of one of the sandstone churches in Sydney.
Oh, there you go.
After a bonsai meeting or something.
That's phenomenal.
And I think it was, one person sitting on the shoulders of another to get type of a scenario.
I love that.
Yeah.
Paint scraping it off the crack. Yeah.
And the other thing is you hear stories of a lot of people pulling them out of gutters. You know, the old leaf litter fills up the gutter and the ficus gets in next thing you know, if you don't get it out, you've got aerial roots to the ground and you've got a strangler figure in the house.
Urban rock crack.
Yeah.
speaking of urban spaces, a student of mine named John, he lives in Sydney, and he used to manage the bowling club at White City in the city. And he collected a ficus off one of their walls that was basically like a disc that was had been continually cut back. Like you could see it had been sawn off. And he extracted just basically did a saw behind the trunk and sawed it off the wall. Over the last sort of 10 years, we've developed it into quite a very fascinating, interesting bonsai because we've propped the disc up as the trunk.
Yeah.
Grown trunks off of that, almost like a clump style. But the trunk is very, extremely two-dimensional.
Yeah.
And what's really curious about it is because it had been there for so long, and this building's quite historic, they'd painted over the ficus when they'd chopped it off.
Yeah.
And then it had calloused over that, and then they'd chopped it off again and painted over it. So there's actually in the callus tissue on the edge of it where the dead wood is in the middle, you see layers of paint through the callus.
That's hilarious.
It's just, it's really shows the human interaction with a collected tree entirely human made, although it arrived there probably on its own.
Well, and that's another aspect of ficus, not as a collected tree, more as a found object in the urban environment. You hear countless stories of, oh, where did this ficus come from? It's like, oh, I found it at the pub. You know, it was in a pot, or it was on, Bill's front doorstep for 40 years in that one same pot. And I went and hacked it down one day and put it in a bonsai pot.
Actually, John, the same student, actually vast majority of his collection has come exactly from that scenario.
Yeah.
He's a real friendly guy. He's driving along. He sees... He loves ficus, so he can spot a ficus from 10,000 miles away, right? You see some ficus leaves on a porch, he'll go up and knock on the door.
Classic urban collector, snooping around people's front lawns.
Yep. it's often at some, older lady, and he's like, oh, tell me about this ficus, and you're getting a, good old yarn about, become friends with them, And then, he might end up with that ficus in the future, and he's acquired 20, 30 trees in that way.
Yeah, and, got the gift of the gab.
And some of them just, my favorite ficus bonsai ever he has in his collection, and I helped him develop it from you were talking about a squib of a ficus that had been in a pot, although this one wasn't super squibby, a couple of inches thick, beautiful trunk with a few big dropping roots coming off of it. We've turned it into very rapidly. I've never seen a ficus that just, the genetic in it is amazing because it just does what you want.
Ah, that's nice.
You prune it, it does exactly what you expect.
Because yeah, not all ficus are, you know, no. of the same quality, or even for some of them not worth pursuing.
No.
Know, some of the, like the Moreton Bay, it'll fight you a lot. You
Moreton Bay is tricky. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it can be done.
Absolutely.
You know, as with all of them, but it's almost like investing your time in the right genetic is a very important thing.
And that's something we've discovered with John's collection, because he has this vast swathe of ficus of all different genetics, predominantly Port Jackson.
Oh, the Port Jackson is just such a beast.
So good. But because he has so many, we've identified different genetic types of Port Jackson.
Port Jackson, yeah.
Now he takes cuttings off of the ones that perform well.
Yeah, good.
And he's starting to curate this production of new material that has better genes for the future. And but it's because he had so many ficus, we were able to go, ooh, that's a good gene. That's a good gene. And it sort of helped us, because I remember a lot of my ficus technique, you know, going into working with John, he was one of the first people who took me on as a mentor. You know, I started working with him, help his collection from the age of, I think, 18. I started working with him over the last, 11 years of working with him. My technique that I rely upon for ficus production is based on the extensive amount of quantity of trees that I've had to play with and collaborate with him on to develop technique for pruning and things like this, to, and seeing how to pivot when different genes throw different genetics of ficus, throw you different sort of curveballs. Fascinating. I never would have probably had that opportunity to work on so many different ficus if I had been working with him.
I think ficus is one of those species I would really encourage anyone coming into bonsai to, you know, acquire as those first couple of pieces, you know, that, you know, because they're bulletproof, you know. I remember all the hardships I put my ficus through. You know, I tried everything, like all the things you were told back in the days where there was, you know, prior to even the bonsai talk, which is prior to Oz Bonsai, there was like a bonsai web, you know. Yep. And on there you'd hear all kinds of crazy, you know, ideas. You know,
everything under the sun.
Drilling holes in the trunk to thicken it, tapping it with a hammer, cutting slits into the trunk. I tried all of them.
Yeah.
Big wedge cuts to move branches. I tried.
Cutting the trunk
in
half like a pizza and putting it back together to make taper.
I did it all. None of those I would recommend as techniques, but the ficus can survive every one of those.
They will be there at the end of the day after all said is
there's
all
a,
is
there's
said
a time
done.
And a place for like maybe a wedge cut out of a branch.
Absolutely.
But there's certainly a time and a place, right?
And in particular, when you start to handle, again, like this tree of Lee Wilson's, incredibly awkward tree, incredibly ancient feel to it. I would never try and adjust what is there in terms of the awkward trunk line. I'm really looking forward to working with that tree to sort of evolve what's there, because it is not only a legacy tree of Lee, but it has such a natural quality to it. Although it has an awkward feel to it, there's always a design way to work with such material.
Well, that's the unique character of the piece.
Absolutely. You know, that is what it is.
If you fight it, you're doing the tree a disservice.
Absolutely.
You build on top of that, then you get something unique. Mm.
And that is, speaking about how to handle Yamadori, that is the mindset I think you have to go in when you're working with collected trees, is honoring what's there.
Yeah, working with the material instead of trying to tell it what to be.
Yes.
You know, like it's like...
That's more reserved for trees you might grow from the ground up.
Yeah, right.
You can have a lot more of information added from yourself in that regard.
I think of like Yamadori a lot like a type of treasure, right? Like a, you know, you might find a sapphire or a diamond, right? But you can't just cut that stone to whatever shape you want.
Mm.
If you're going to cut it, the stone presents what type of cut you should make on it.
You might have a fault down one side you have to work with and like keep that as part of it, or that backing of the stone has to exist in it, you know.
Yeah, right. So, and it's the same with the collected piece. Mm-hmm. You know, if you try to work against it, you're going to fail instantly. Yeah.
And so much of working of Yamadori is a part, again, about selection, whether that's you collecting it yourself or purchasing a piece of Yamadori material from a collector or a tree that you can see evidence of being collected in the past. If it's a piece of material that you don't feel like you can honor or are interested in honoring for what is there, maybe that's not the piece of material for you.
No, leave that for someone that will.
Yeah. They're special things.
They are beautiful things.
Yeah, so much fun. It's definitely my favorite type of material to work with in terms of where has the material been sourced is the wild tree.
Yeah, the wild tree, and also the long-term domesticated tree is another fun one.
Yeah, they almost feel like they're cut off the same block, just from a different root. same feeling of legacy.
Yeah, well, the older pot-grown trees, they've often gone through periods of hardship. And even then, they might have originally been designed with a very conventional Western traditional styling. Sooner or later, somewhere along the line, something goes wrong. Yeah. You know, the tree sheds something, a piece of the tree will die away. You know, at the time, I think the people think that that's the grower thinks, it was a mistake or a failing or whatever. But given enough time, sometimes that is what creates that unique characteristic in the tree that makes it worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah. The tree will embody that characteristic over time, soften. Yeah.
It's just part of the story. Yeah, I heard this beautiful quote. I'm not sure the source of it, and I'll probably hack it, but the general sense of it was, a beautiful old tree is a piece of poetry created by the wind and the storms and the elements. And the Yamadori embody that. You can read the history of that tree if you know what to look at.
Well, the collected tree, it embodies the environment for what it is. I've had multiple conversations with people about, you see, in the Northern Hemisphere, collected conifers like junipers, and they'll have very, very, very elaborate, almost you might conceive as abstract deadwood, and commentary around, I'm not sure if I enjoy this because it doesn't look natural. And in a sense, from the viewer of someone who maybe not understand that kind of tree, they might perceive it as unnatural. But the irony is, those trees came from nature.
Yeah,
they are more natural than anything else because they are literally from the environment itself.
Yeah, I mean, that form is just not common in Australia, right?
We don't get to see it.
I didn't really understand the context until I saw them in the mountains of Tasmania. Yeah. You know, the Athrotaxus out there. They're some of the best wild trees in Australia for that Krumholz form.
Yeah,
undeniably so.
They do exist. It's just that environment is a smaller environment in this country.
Yeah,
you do see though a similar aesthetic emulated on the coast.
Yeah.
If you find really, I think to this day protected coastal environments, you'll see pretty ancient tree forms growing in that Krumholz form, formed via coastal winds and things like that. You won't get the same kind of deadwood formation, but you'll get the same interaction of deadwood live compactness in the trees.
Yeah, you certainly get the vibe. I think it's the difference is antiquity.
Yes, definitely not as old for sure. Yeah. Rivers will create a very similar sort of aesthetic as well.
And the desert.
Yeah, in the desert.
So it's out there. I think we're very urbanized.
Yeah. Well, I think because in Australia we are we're confined, so much of our population is on the coast, and the vast interior of the country, although is populated somewhat, is extremely sparse comparatively. So the vast majority of us aren't experiencing those places or seeing those trees or accessing those trees that would have, like in those desert landscapes, that might have extreme antiquity, but we just don't see them because there's not as many feet on the floor seeing them and allowing us to expose. And even myself, I haven't been out and seen those kind of places.
It's a hugely vast landscape, and it's most of the country. It's quite dangerous to go out there unprepared. Yeah, if you don't know what you're doing out there, it's a good
absolutely.
Way to die.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. Oh shit, that wasn't a good idea.
yeah. And you'd be thinking about it for those 5 days you were walking through the blistering sun thinking, gee, I'm thirsty.
Yeah. Absolutely. But definitely a space for inspiration and potentially even resources for such trees.
I'd assume so.
I love this topic. I find it it's really fun and fascinating.
Yeah, it's just another exploration.
Absolutely.
Well, I reckon we should probably wrap this one up.
Yeah, that was
pretty quick and clean because it's been a long week.
Yeah, it's been a good week, long week. Yeah. You ready to go home?
Ah, it's always nice going home, but it's the thing about going home is it's going back to reality in a way.
Yep.
And I got to go back and address a few things, like the ute's been torched. So my car was unfortunately stolen and set on fire. So
yeah, hectic.
Got to go and work that one out, and a few other bits and pieces.
It was probably nice. It happened just before you came up for a visit.
Yeah,
you kind of be like, oh, that happened. All right, I'll just mull on this for the next week while I'm away.
Yeah, I got it towed back and
separate sort of from it.
Dumped on the property and
yep.
Yeah, work that one out. But it's just one of those spanner in the works that life throws at you.
That's it. Yeah, nothing's unfixable. Part of the fun. That's right.
Well, this one might be unfixable.
Yeah. In this case, maybe.
Yeah, well, it's just outside my wheelhouse.
That's right.
I can renovate an old bonsai. that's been burnout, but
yeah. A car is a kind of a different piece of material to
I need a
to salvage
a car professional. A mechanic.
Yeah, you should get one in.
Yeah.
They're really helpful. All right, awesome. Well, thanks, Jared. Awesome chat.
Pleasure as always, mate.
All right, see you guys next time.